Gee, where should I look, huh?
Ha ha! The shuttle laughed. I suppose you'd best look up here, forward, toward the bulkhead.
Hawser did so.
See that little round thing right in the middle near the ceiling? That's one of my eyes.
Oh, Hawser said. He waved and smiled. Hi, my name's Orab.
Hello, Orab. I'm Tsiltseer. Actually, that's only part of my name designation, but you can call me that. What was happening out there? I haven't been watching the people I'm here to rescue. I was told not to in case I got upset. But I did hear people screaming when they came near, and they seemed frightened when they came inside me. Then they saw you and ran away. What is that you're holding? Is it a gun? I'll have to ask you to put that away for safekeeping. I'm here to rescue people who want to be rescued when the orbital is destructed, and we can't have dangerous weapons on board in case somebody gets hurt, can we? Is that finger hurt? I have a very good med kit on board. Would you like to use it, Orab?
Yes, that might be an idea.
Good. It's on the inward side of the doorway through to my front compartment on the left.
Hawser started walking past the rows of seats toward the front of the shuttle. For all its age, the shuttle smelled of... he wasn't quite sure. All the synthetic materials it was made from, he supposed. After the natural but god-awful odours of the last day, Hawser found the shuttle much more pleasant, even if it was culture and therefore belonged to the enemy. Hawser touched the gun he was carrying as though doing something to it. Just putting the safety catch on, he told the eye in the ceiling. Don't want it to go off, but those people out there were trying to kill me earlier, and I feel safer with it in my hand. Know what I mean?
Well, not exactly, Orab, the shuttle said, but I think I can understand. But you'll have to give the gun to me before we take off.
Oh, sure, as soon as you close those rear doors. Hawser was in the doorway between the main compartment and the smaller control area now. It was, in fact, a very short corridor, less than 2 meters long, with open doors to each compartment. Hawser looked round quickly, but he couldn't see another eye. He watched a large flap open at about hip level to reveal a comprehensive medical kit.
Well, Orab, I'd close those doors to make you feel a bit safer if I could, but you see, I'm here to rescue people who want to be rescued when the time comes to destruct the orbital, and I can't close those doors until just before I leave, so that everybody who wants to can get on board. Actually, I can't really understand why anybody wouldn't want to escape, but they told me not to get worried if some people stayed behind. But I must say, I think that would be kind of silly, don't you, Orab?
Hawser was rummaging through the med kit before looking above it at other outlines of doors set in the wall of the short corridor. He said,
Yeah, that would be. When is the place due to blow, anyway?
He poked his head round the corner into the control compartment or flight deck, looking up at another eye set in the corresponding position to the one in the main compartment, but looking forward from the other side of the thick wall between the two. Hawser grinned and gave a little wave, then ducked back.
Hi, the shuttle laughed. Well, Orab, I'm afraid that we're going to be forced to destruct the orbital in 43 standard hours, unless, of course, the adherents see sense and are reasonable and withdraw their threat to use Vavatch as a warbase.
Oh, Hawser said. He was looking at one of the door outlines above the opened one the medkit was protruding from. As far as he could guess, those two eyes were back to back, separated by the thickness of the wall between the two compartments. Unless there was a mirror he couldn't see, he was invisible to the shuttle while he remained in the short corridor. He looked back, out through the open rear doors. The only movement came from the tops of some distant trees and the smoke from the fires. He checked the gun. The projectiles seemed to be hidden in some sort of magazine, but a little circular indicator with a sweep hand indicated either one bullet left or one expended out of 12.
Yes, the shuttle said. It's very sad, of course, but these things are necessary in wartime, I suppose. Not that I pretend to understand it all. I'm just a humble shuttle, after all. I'd actually been given away as a present to one of the megaships because I was too old-fashioned and crude for the culture, you know. I thought they could have upgraded me, but they didn't. They just gave me away. Anyway, they need me now, I'm happy to say. We have quite a job on our hands, you know, getting everybody who wants to get off away from Vavatch. I'll be sorry to see it go. I've had some happy times here, believe me. But that's just the way things go, I suppose. How's that finger going, by the way? Want me to have a look at it? Bring the medkit stuff round into one of the two compartments, so I can take a look. I might be able to help, you know. Oh, are you touching one of the other lockers in that corridor?
Hawser was trying to lever open the door nearest the roof by using the barrel of the gun.
No, he said, heaving away at it. I'm nowhere near it.
That's odd. I'm sure I can feel something. Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure, Hawser said, putting all his weight behind the gun. The door gave way, revealing tubes, fiber runs, metal bottles and various other unrecognizable bits of machinery, electrics, optics and field units.
Ouch, said the shuttle.
Hey, Hawser shouted. It just blew open. There's something on fire in there. He raised the gun, holding it in both hands. He sighted carefully.
About there. Fire, yelped the shuttle. But that's not possible.
You think I can't tell smoke when I see it, you crazy goddamn machine? Hawser yelled. He pulled the trigger. The gun exploded, throwing his hands up and him back. The noise of the shuttle's exclamation was covered by the crack and bang of the bullet hitting inside and exploding. Hawser covered his face with his arm.
I'm blind, wailed the shuttle.
Now smoke really was pouring from the compartment Hawser had opened. He staggered into the control compartment.
You're on fire in here too, he yelled. There's smoke coming out everywhere. What? But that can't be.
You're on fire. I don't know how you can't feel it or smell it. You're burning.
I don't trust you, the machine yelled. Put that gun away, or...
You've got to trust me, Hawser yelled, looking all over the control area for where the shuttle's brain might be located. He could see screens and seats, readout screens, and even the place where manual controls might be hidden, but no indication of where the brain was.
Smoke's pouring out everywhere, he repeated, trying to sound hysterical. Here's an extinguisher. I'm turning mine on, the machine shouted.
A wall unit spun round, and Hawser grabbed the bulky cylinder attached to the inside of the flap. He wrapped his four good fingers on his injured hand around the pistol grip. A hissing noise and a light vapour-like steam was appearing from various places in the compartment.
Nothing's happening, Hawser screamed. There's loads of black smoke and it's...
He pretended to cough.
It's getting thicker. Where is it coming from? Quickly!
Everywhere, Hawser yelled, glancing all round the control area.
From near your eye, under the seats, over the screens, under the screens, I can't see. Go on, I can smell smoke too now.
Hawser looked at the slight smudge of grey filtering into the control area from the spluttering fire in the short corridor where he had shot the craft.
It's coming from those places and those info screens on either side of the end seats and just above the seats on the side walls where that bit juts out. What? Screamed the shuttle brain. On the left, facing forward?
Yes.
Put that one out first,
the shuttle screeched. Hawser dropped the extinguisher and gripped the gun in both hands again, aiming it at the bulge in the wall over the left-hand seat. He pulled the trigger once, twice, three times. The gun blasted, shaking his whole body. Sparks and bits of flying debris flew from the holes the bullets were smashing in the casing of the machine.
Eee!
Said the shuttle. Then there was silence. Smoke rose from the bulge, and it joined with that coming from the corridor to form a thin layer under the ceiling. Hawser let the gun down slowly, looking around and listening.
Mug, he said.
He used the handheld extinguisher to put out the small fires in the wall of the corridor and where the shuttle's brain had been. Then he went out into the passenger area to sit near the open doors while the smoke and the fumes cleared. He couldn't see any eaters on the sand or in the forest, and the canoes were out of sight too. He looked for some door controls and found them. The doors closed with a hiss, and Hawser grinned. He went back to the control area and started punching buttons and opening sections of panelling until he got some life from the screens. They all suddenly blinked on while he was fiddling with some buttons on the arm of one of the couch-like seats. The noise of the surf in the flight deck made him think the doors had opened again, but it was only some external microphones relaying the noise from outside. Screens flickered and lit up with figures and lines, and flaps opened in front of the seats. Control wheels and levers sighed out smoothly and clicked into place, just ready to be held and used. Feeling happier than he had been in many days, Hawser started an eventually successful but longer and more frustrating search for some food. He was very hungry. Some small insects were running in orderly lines over the huge body collapsed on the sands, one hand of which was sticking, charred and blackened, into the dying flames of a fire. The little insects started by eating the deep-set eyes, which were open. They hardly noticed as the shuttle rose, wobbling into the air, picked up speed and turned inelegantly above the mountain, then roared off through the early evening air, away from the island. Interlude in Darkness. The mind had an image to illustrate its information capacity. It liked to imagine the contents of its memory store written out on cards,
little slips of paper with tiny writing on them, big enough for a human to read. If the characters were a couple of millimetres tall and the paper about 10 centimetres square and written on both sides, then 10,000 characters could be squeezed onto each card. In a metre-long drawer of such cards, maybe 1,000 of them, 10 million pieces of information could be stored. In a small room, a few metres square, with a corridor in the middle just wide enough to pull a tray out into, you could keep perhaps 1,000 trays arranged in close-packed cabinets, 10 billion characters in all. A square kilometre of these cramped cells might contain as many as 100,000 rooms. 1,000 such floors would produce a building 2,000 metres tall with 100 million rooms. If you kept building those squat towers, squeezed hard up against each other, until they entirely covered the surface of a largish standard G world, maybe 1 billion square kilometres, you would have a planet with 1 trillion square kilometres of floor space. 100 quadrillion paper-stuffed rooms, 30 light-years of corridors, and a number of potential stored characters sufficiently large to boggle just about anybody's mind. In base 10, that number would be a 1, followed by 27 zeros, and even that vast figure was only a fraction of the capacity of the mind. To match it, you would need 1,000 such worlds, systems of them, a clusterful of information-packed globes, and that vast capacity was physically contained within a space smaller than a single one of those tiny rooms inside the mind. In darkness, the mind waited. It had counted how long it had waited so far. It had tried to estimate how long it would have to wait in the future. It knew, to the smallest imaginable fraction of a second, how long it had been in the tunnels of the command system, and, more often than it needed to, it thought about that number, watched it grow inside itself. It was a form of security, it supposed, a small fetish, something to cling to. It had explored the command system tunnels, scanning and surveying. It was weak, damaged, almost totally helpless. But it had been worthwhile taking a look around the maze-like complex of tunnels and caverns, just to take its attention off the fact that it was there as a refugee. The places it could not get to itself, it sent its one remaining remote drone into, so that it could have a look and see what there was to be seen. And all of it was at once boring and frighteningly depressing. The level of technology possessed by the builders of the command system was very limited indeed. Everything in the tunnels worked either mechanically or electronically. Gears and wheels, electric wires, superconductors and light fibres. Very crude indeed, the mind thought, and nothing it could possibly interest itself in. A glance through any of the machines and devices in the tunnel was sufficient to know them exactly. What they were made of, how they had been made, even what they were made for. No mystery. Nothing to employ the mind. There was something, too, about the inexactitude of it all that the mind found almost frightening. It could look at some carefully machined piece of metal or some delicately moulded bit of plastic and know that, to the people who had built the command system, to their eyes, these things were exact and precise, constructed to fine tolerances with dead straight lines, perfect edges, smooth surfaces, immaculate right angles, and so on. But the mind, even with its damaged senses, could see the rough edges, the crudity of the parts and the components involved. They had been good enough for the people at the time, and no doubt they had fulfilled the most important criterion of all. They worked. But they were crude, clumsy, imperfectly designed and manufactured. For some reason, the mind found this worrying. And it would have to use this ancient, crude, shop-soiled technology. It would have to connect with it. It had thought it through as best it could, and decided to formulate plans for what to do if the Adirans did get somebody through the quiet barrier and threatened it with discovery. It would arm, and it would make a place to hide in. Both actions implied damage to the command system, so it would not act until it knew it was definitely threatened. Once it knew it was, it would be forced to risk the Draazen's displeasure. But it might not come to that. It hoped it wouldn't. Planning was one thing. Execution was another. It was unlikely to have very much time either to hide or to arm. Both plans might perforce be rather crudely implemented, especially as it had only one remote drone and its own badly crippled fields with which to manipulate the engineering facilities of the system. Better than nothing, though. Better still to have problems than to let death eradicate them all. There was, however, another less immediately relevant, but more intrinsically worrying problem it had discovered, and it was implied in the question, who was it? Its higher functions had had to close down when it had transferred from 4 to 3-dimensional space. The mind's information was held in binary form, in spirals composed of protons and neutrons, and neutrons, outside a nucleus and also outside hyperspace, decayed into protons, not too long after entering the command system. The vast majority of its memory would have consisted of the stunningly illuminating message 000000. So, it had effectively frozen its primary memory and cognitive functions, wrapping them in fields which prevented both decay and use. It was working instead on backup Pica circuitry in real space and using real space light to think with. How humiliating. In fact, it could still access all that stored memory, though the process was complicated and so slow. So all was not lost there. But as for thinking, as for being itself, another matter entirely. It wasn't its real self. It was a crude, abstracted copy of itself, the mere ground plan for the full labyrinthine complexity of its true personality. It was the truest possible copy its limited scale was theoretically capable of providing. And it was still sentient, conscious by even the most rigorous of standards. Yet an index was not the text. A street plan was not the city, a map, not the land. So, who was it? Not the entity it thought it was, that was the answer. And it was a disconcerting one, because it knew that the self it was now could never think of all the things its old self would have thought of. It felt unworthy. It felt fallible and limited and dull. But think positively. Patterns, images, the telling analogy. Make the ill work to good. Just think. If it was not itself, then it would be not itself. As it was now to what it had been before, so the remote drone was to it now. Nice connection. The remote drone would be more than just its eyes and ears on the surface, in or near the changes base, keeping lookout. More than just its assistant in the doubtless frantic preparations to equip and secrete which would ensue if the drone did raise the alarm. More. And less. Look on the happy side. Think of the good things. Hadn't it been clever? Yes, it had. Its escape from the spare parts warship had been, though it thought it itself, quite breathtakingly masterful and brilliant. Its courageous use of warp so deep into a gravity well would have been foolhardy in the extreme in anything else but the dire circumstances it had found itself in, but was anyway superbly skilled. And its stunning cross-realm transfer from hyper to real space was not simply even more brilliant and even braver than anything else it had done. It was almost certainly a first. There was nothing anywhere in its vast store of information to indicate that anybody had ever done that before. It was proud. But after all that, here it was, trapped, an intellectual cripple, a philosophical shadow of its former self. Now all it could do was wait, hoping that whoever came to find it would be friendly. The culture must know. The mind was certain its signal had worked and that it would be picked up somewhere. But the Idirans knew as well. It didn't think they would just try to storm in because they knew as well as it did that antagonizing the Draazen was a bad idea. But what if the Idirans found a way in and the culture couldn't? What if the whole region of space around the sullen gulf was now Idiran-held? The mind knew there was only one thing it could do if it fell into Idiran hands. But not only did it not want to destruct for purely personal reasons, it didn't want to destruct anywhere near Shah's world anyway, for the same reason that the Idirans wouldn't come charging in. But if it was captured in the planet, that might be the last time it would have a chance to destroy itself. By the time it was taken off the planet, the Idirans might have found a way of stopping it from destructing. Perhaps it had made a mistake in escaping at all. Perhaps it should have just destructed along with the rest of the ship and saved all this complication and worry. But it had seemed like an almost heaven-sent opportunity to escape, finding itself so close to a planet of the dead when it had been attacked. It wanted to live anyway, but it would have been wasteful to throw away such a great chance, even if it had been perfectly sanguine about its own survival or destruction. Well, there was nothing to be done about it now. It was here,
and it just had to wait. Wait and think. Consider all the options, few, and possibilities, many. Rack those memories as best it could for anything that might be relevant, that might help. For example, and the one really interesting bit would be a bad one, it had discovered that the Adirans had probably employed one of the changers who had actually served with the caretaker staff on Shah's world. Of course, perhaps the man was dead, or busy on something else, or too far away, or the information had been incorrect in the first place, and the intelligence-gathering section of the culture had got it wrong. But if not, then that man would be the one obvious person to send after something hiding in the command system tunnels. It was part of the mind's very construction, at every level, to believe that there was no such thing as bad knowledge, except in very relative terms. But it really did wish that it hadn't had that bit of information in its memory banks. It would just as soon not have known anything about this man, this changer who knew Shah's world, and probably worked for the Adirans. Perversely, it found itself wishing it knew this man's name. But with any luck, he would be irrelevant, or the culture would get here first, or the Dra'ezan being would recognize a fellow mind in trouble and help, or anything. In darkness, the mind waited. Hundreds of those planets were empty. The 100 million room towers were there, the little rooms, the cabinets and the trays and the cards and the spaces for the numbers and letters were there. But nothing was written, nothing held on any of the cards. Sometimes the mind liked to imagine travelling down the narrow spaces between the cabinets, one of its remote drones floating between the banked files of memory in the thin corridors, from room to room, for floor after floor, kilometre after kilometre, over buried continents of rooms, filled in oceans of rooms, levelled ranges, felled forests, covered deserts of rooms. These whole systems of dark planets, those trillions of square kilometres of blank paper, represented the mind's future, the spaces it would fill in its life to come. If it had one. Chapter 7. A Game of Damage.
Damage. The game banned everywhere. Tonight, in that unprepossessing building across the square under the dome, they'll gather. The players of the Eve of Destruction. The most select group of rich psychotics in the human galaxy, here to play the game that is to real life what soap opera is to high tragedy. This is the biport city of Evenalth, Vavach Orbital. The very same Vavach Orbital that in about 11 standard hours from now is due to be blasted into its component atoms as the Adiran culture war in this part of the galaxy, near the Glittercliff and Sullen Gulf, reaches a new high in standing by your principles regardless, and a new low in common sense. It's that imminent destruction that's attracted these scatological vultures here, not the famous megaships or the azure blue technological miracles of the Circle Sea. No. These people are here because the whole orbital is doomed to be blown away shortly, and they think it's kind of amusing to play Damage, an ordinary card game with a few embellishments to make it attractive to the mentally disturbed in places on the verge of annihilation. They've played on worlds about to suffer massive comet or meteorite strikes, in volcanic calderas about to blow, in cities due for nuclear bombardment in ritualistic wars, in asteroids heading for the center of stars, in front of moving cliffs of ice or lava, inside mysterious alien spacecraft discovered empty and deserted and set on courses aiming them into black holes, in vast palaces about to be sacked by android mobs, and just about everywhere you can think of you'd rather not want to be immediately after the players leave. It might seem like a strange sort of way to get your kicks, but it takes all sorts to make a galaxy, I guess. So here they've come, these hyper-rich deadbeats, in their rented ships or their own cruisers. Right now they're sobering up and coming down, going through plastic surgery or behaviour therapy or both, to make them acceptable in what passes for normal society, even in these rarefied circles, after months spent in whatever expensive and unlikely debauchery or perversion particularly appeals to them or happens to be in fashion at the moment. At the same time, they or their minions are scraping together their Aoish credits, all actual, no notes, and scouting hospitals, asylums, and free stores for new lives. Here too have come the hangers-on, the damage groupies, the fortune-seekers, the past failures of the game desperate for another try if they can only raise the money and the lives, and Damage's very own special sort of human debris, the Motis, victims of the game's emotional fallout. Mind junkies, who only exist to lap at the crumbs of ecstasy and anguish falling from the lips of their heroes, the players of the game. Nobody knows exactly how all these different groups hear about the game, or even how they all get here in time, but the word goes out to those who really need to or want to hear about it, and like ghouls they come, ready for the game and the destruction. Originally, Damage was played on such occasions because only during the breakdown of law and morality, and the confusion and chaos normally surrounding final events, could the game be carried out in anything remotely resembling part of the civilized galaxy, which, believe it or not, the players like to think they are part of. Now, the subsequent Nova, world-busting or other cataclysm is seen as some sort of metaphysical symbol for the mortality of all things, and as the lives involved in a full game are all volunteers, a lot of places, like good old pleasure-oriented permissive Vavach, let the game take place with official blessing from the authorities. Some people say it's not the game it used to be, even that it's become something of a media event, but I say it's still a game for the mad and the bad. The rich and the uncaring, but not the careless. The unhinged, but well-connected. People still die in Damage, and not just the lives either, or the players. It's been called the most decadent game in history. About all you can say in the game's defense is that it, rather than reality, occupies the warped minds of some of the galaxy's more twisted people. Gods know what they would get up to if it wasn't there. And if the game does any good, apart from reminding us, as if we needed reminding, how crazy the bipedal, oxygen-breathing carboniform can become, it does occasionally remove one of the players and frighten the rest for a while. In these arguably insane times, any lessening or attenuation of madness is maybe something to be grateful for. I'll be filing another report again sometime during the course of the game, from within the auditorium, if I can get in there. But in the meantime, goodbye and take care. This is Sarble the Eye, Evenouth City, Vavach.
The image on the wrist screen of a man standing in sunlight on a plaza faded, the half-masked youngish face disappearing. Halser put his terminal screen back onto his cuff. The time display winked slowly with the countdown to Vavach's destruction. Sarble the Eye, one of the most famous of the humanoid galaxy's freelance reporters, and also one of the most successful at getting into places he wasn't supposed to, would now probably be trying to enter the games hall, if he hadn't got in already. The broadcast Hauser had just watched had been recorded that afternoon. Doubtless, Sarble would be in disguise, so Hauser was glad he'd bribed his way in before the reporter's broadcast went out, and the security guards around the hall got even more wary. It had been hard enough as it was. Hauser, in his new guise as Craiklin, had posed as a Moti, one of the emotional junkies who followed the erratic, secretive progress of the major game series round the more tawdry fringes of civilization, having discovered that all but the most expensive reserved places had been sold out the day before. The 5 Aoish credit tenths he had started out with that morning were now reduced to 3, though he also had some money keyed into a couple of credit cards he'd bought. That currency would shrink in real value, though, as the destruction time drew nearer. Hauser took a deep, satisfying breath and looked around the big arena. He had climbed as high as he could up the banked steps, slopes and platforms, using the interval before the game began to get an overview of the whole thing. The dome of the arena was transparent, showing stars and the bright, shining line that was the orbital's far side, now in daylight. The lights of shuttles coming and going, mostly going, traced lines across the still points. Beneath the dome cover hung a smoky haze lit with the popping lights of a small firework display. The air was filled, too, with the chanting of massed voices. A choir of scale cones stood banked on the far side of the auditorium. The humanoids forming the choir appeared identical in all but stature and in the tones they produced from their puffed-out chests and long necks. They seemed to be making the ambient racket, but as he looked around the arena, Hauser could make out the faint purple edges in the air where other more localized sand fields held command, over smaller stages where dancers danced, singers sang, strippers stripped, boxers boxed, or people just stood around talking. Banked all around, the paraphernalia of the game seethed like a vast storm. Maybe 10 or even 20,000 people, mostly humanoid, but some utterly different, including not a few machines and drones. They sat, or lay, or walked, or stood, watching magicians, jugglers, fighters, immolators, hypnotics, couplers, actors, orators, and 100 other types of entertainers all doing their turns. Tents had been pitched on some of the larger terraces. Rows of seats and couches remained on others. Many small stages frazzled with lights, smoke and glittering holograms and soligrams. Halser saw a 3D maze spread out over several terraces, full of tubes and angles, some clear, some opaque, some moving, some staying still. Shadows and forms moved inside. A slow-motion animal trapeze act arced gradually overhead. Hawser recognised the beasts performing it. It would become a combat act later on. Some people walked by Hawser. Tall humanoids in fabulous clothes, glittering like a gaudy night city seen from the air. They chattered in almost inaudibly high voices, and from a network of fine golden-coloured tubes branching all around their bright red and dark purple faces, tiny puffs of incandescent gas pulsed out, wreathing their semi-scaled necks and naked shoulders and trailing and dimming behind them in a fiery orange glow. Hawser watched them pass. Their cloaks, flowing out behind as though hardly heavier than the air through which they moved, flickered with the image of an alien face, each cloak showing part of one huge moving image, as though a projector overhead was focused on the capes of the moving group. The orange gas touched Hawser's nostrils, and his head swam for a second. He let his immune glands deal with the narcotic and continued to look around the arena. The eye of the storm, the still, quiet spot, was so small it could easily have been missed in even a slow and attentive scan of the auditorium. It was not in the centre, but set at one end of the ellipsoid of level ground forming the lowest visible level of the arena. There, under a canopy of still dark lighting units, a round table stood, just about large enough to accommodate at its rim the 16 large, differently styled chairs which each faced a wedge of colour fixed to the top of the table. A console, set into the table itself, faced each chair, on which straps and other restraining devices lay opened. Behind each of the seats lay an area of clear space on which small seats, 12 in all, were placed. A small fence separated them from the larger seats in front, and another fence cordoned off the set of 12 seats from a larger area behind, where people, most of them motis, were already quietly waiting. The game seemed to have been delayed. Hawser sat down on what was either an over-designed seat or a rather unimaginative piece of sculpture. He was almost on the highest level of the terraces of the arena, with a good view over most of the rest. There was nobody nearby. He reached deep inside his heavy blouse and peeled off some artificial skin from his abdomen. He rolled the skin into a ball and threw it into a large pot that held a small tree, just behind where he sat. Then he checked the Aoish credit tenths, the negotiable memory card, the pocket terminal and the light CRE pistol which had been hidden by the paunch of fake skin. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw a small, darkly dressed man approach. The man looked at Hawser with his head tilted, from about 5 meters off, then came closer.
"Hey, you want to be alive?"
"No, goodbye," Hawser said. The small man sniffed and walked off, stopping further along the walkway to prod a shape lying near the edge of a narrow terrace. Hawser looked over and saw a woman there raise her head groggily, then shake it slowly, moving sinuous lengths of bedraggled white hair. Her face showed briefly in the light of an overhead spot. She was beautiful, but looked very tired. The small man spoke to her again, but she shook her head and made a motion with one hand. The small man walked off. The flight in the X-Culture shuttle had been relatively uneventful. After some confusion, Hawser had succeeded in patching through to the orbital's navigation system, discovered where he was in relation to the Almadreka's last known position, and set off to find whatever was left of the megaship. He'd accessed a news service while gorging himself on culture emergency rations, and found a report on the Almadreka in the index. The pictures showed the ship, listing a little and fractionally bow down, floating in a calm sea surrounded by ice, the first kilometre of its hull seemingly buried inside the huge tabula berg. Small aircraft and a few shuttles hovered and flew about the gigantic wreck, like flies above the carcass of a dinosaur. The commentary accompanying the visuals spoke of a mysterious second nuclear explosion aboard the craft. It also reported that when police craft had arrived, the megaship had proved to be deserted. Hearing that, Hawser had immediately altered the shuttle's destination, swinging the craft round to head for Ivanov. Hawser had had 3/10 of an Aoish credit. He'd sold the shuttle for 5/10. It was absurdly cheap, especially given the imminent destruction of the orbital. But he had been in a hurry, and the dealer who accepted the craft was certainly taking a risk handling the machine. It was very obviously a cultured design. The brain had equally obviously been shot out of it, so there could be little doubt it had been stolen. The culture would treat the destruction of the craft's consciousness as murder. In 3 hours, Hawser had sold the shuttle, bought clothes, cards, a gun, a couple of terminals, and some information. All except the information had been cheap. Hawser now knew that there was a craft answering the description of the clear air turbulence on the orbital, or rather underneath it, inside the ex-culture general systems vehicle called the Ends of Invention. He found that hard to believe, but there was no other craft it could be. According to the information agency, a ship fitting the cat's description had been brought on board by one of the Evenauth port shipbuilders to have repairs made to its warping units. It had arrived under tow 2 days previously, with only its fusion motors working. He could not, however, find out its name or exact location. It sounded to Hawser like the cat had been used to rescue the survivors of Craiklin's band. It must have come over the O wall on remote control, using its warp units. It had picked the free company up, then hopped back over again, damaging its warp motors in the process. He had also been unable to find out who the survivors might be, but assumed Craiklin must be one of them. Nobody else could have brought the cat over the edge wall. He hoped he'd find Craiklin at the damage game. Either way, Hawser had decided to make for the cat afterward. He still intended to head for Shah's world, and the clear air turbulence was the most likely way of getting there. He hoped Yalson was alive. He also hoped it was true about the Ends of Invention being totally demilitarized and the volume around Vavach being free of culture ships. After all this time, he wouldn't have put it past the culture's minds to have found out about the cat being in the same volume of space as the Hand of God 137 when it came under attack, and to have made a connection or two. He sat back in the seat, or sculpture, and relaxed, letting the internal pattern of the Moti drop from his mind and body. He had to start thinking like Craiklin again. He closed his eyes. After a few minutes, he could hear things starting to happen down in the lower reaches of the arena. He brought himself to and looked around. The white-haired woman who'd been lying on the nearby terrace had got up. She was walking, a little unsteadily, down into the arena, her long, heavy dress sweeping over the steps. Hawser got up too, following quickly down the stairs in the wake of her perfume. She didn't look at him when he skipped past her. She was fiddling with an askew tiara. The lights were on over the coloured table where the game would be played. Some of the stages in the auditorium were starting to close up or go dim. People were gradually gravitating toward the game table, to the seats and lounges and standing areas overlooking it. In the glare of the overhead lights, tall figures in black robes moved slowly, checking pieces of the game equipment. They were the adjudicators, Ishlor Sinami. The species renowned for being the most unimaginative, humourless, prissy, honest and incorruptible group in the galaxy, and they always officiated at damage games because hardly anybody else could be trusted. Hawser stopped by a food stall to stock up on food and drink. He watched the game table and the figures around it while his order was prepared. The woman with the heavy dress and the long white hair passed him, still going down the steps. Her tiara was almost straight, though her long, loose gown was crumpled. She yawned as she went past. Hawser paid for his food with a card, then followed the woman again, going toward the growing crowd of people and machines starting to cluster all around the outer perimeter of the game area. The woman looked suspiciously at him when he half ran, half walked down the steps past her again. Hawser bribed his way into one of the better terraces. He pulled the hood of his heavy blouse out from the thick collar, stretching it over his forehead and out a little so that his face was in shadow. He didn't want the real Craiklin to see him now. The terrace jutted out over lower ones, slanting down with an excellent view of the table itself and the gantries above. Most of the fenced areas around the table were visible too. Hawser settled onto a soft lounger near a noisy group of extravagantly dressed tripedals who hooted a lot and kept spitting into a large pot in the centre of their group of gently rocking couches. The Ishlor Sinami seemed to have satisfied themselves that everything was working and were set up fairly. They walked down a ramp set into the surface of the arena's ellipsoid floor. Some lights went off. A quiet field slowly cut off the sounds from the rest of the auditorium. Hawser took a quick look round. A few stages and sets still showed lights, but they were going out. The slow-motion animal trapeze act was still going on, though high up in the darkness below the stars. The huge, ponderous beasts were swinging through the air, field harnesses glittering. They somersaulted and twisted, but now, as they did so, passing each other in midair, they reached out with their clawed paws, slashing slowly and silently at each other's fur. Nobody else seemed to be watching. Hawser was surprised to see the woman he had passed twice on the stairs walk past him again and drape herself over a vacant couch which had been reserved near the front of the terrace. Somehow, he hadn't thought she would be rich enough to afford this area. Without a fanfare or announcement, the players of the Eve of Destruction appeared, coming up the ramp in the arena floor, led by a single Ishlorsin army. Hawser checked his terminal. It was exactly 7 hours standard to the orbital's destruction. Applause, cheers, and, near Hawser at least, loud hooting greeted the contestants, though the quiet fields muffled everything. As they appeared from the shadows on the ramp, some of the players acknowledged the crowd who had come to see them play, while other players totally ignored them. Hawser recognised few of them. The ones he did know, or had at least heard of, were Galsel, Tengayet Doisuyut, Wilgra, and Nipolax. Galsel of Galsel's Raiders, probably the most successful of the free companies. Hawser had heard the mercenary ship arrive from about 11 kilometres away while he was making the deal with the shuttle saleswoman. She had frozen at the time, her eyes glazed. Hawser didn't like to ask whether she thought the noise was the culture coming to destroy the orbital a few hours early, or just coming to get her for buying a hot shuttlecraft. Galsel was an average-looking man, stocky enough to be obviously from a high-G planet, but without the look of compressed power that most such people possessed. He was simply dressed, and his head was clean-shaven. Supposedly, only a damage game where such things were banned could force Galsel out of the suit he always wore. Tengayet Doisuyut was tall, very dark, and also simply dressed. The Suyut was the champion damage player on both game average, wins, and maximum credits. He had come from a recently contacted planet 20 years before and had been a champion player of games of chance and bluff there too. That was where he had had his face removed and a stainless steel mask grafted on. Only the eyes looked alive, expressionless soft jewels set in the sculpted metal. The mask had a matte finish to present his opponent seeing his cards reflected in his face. Wilgra had to be helped up the ramp by some slaves from his retinue. The blue giant from Ojle, clad in a mirror robe, looked almost as though he was being rolled up the slope by the small humans behind, although the hem of his robe kicked out now and again to show where his four stubby legs were scrabbling to propel his great body up the ramp. In one of his two hands, he held a large mirror, in the other, a whip lead, on the end of which a blinded Rogothoir, its four paws encrusted with precious metals, its snout encased in a platinum muzzle, and its eyes replaced by emeralds, padded like a lithe nightmare in pure white. The animal's giant head swept from side to side as it used its ultrasonic sense to map out its surroundings. On another terrace, almost opposite Hawser's, all 32 of Wilgra's concubines threw aside their body veils and went down on their knees and elbows, worshipping their lord. He waved the mirror at them briefly. Virtually every magnifier and micro-camera smuggled into the auditorium also swiveled to focus on the 32 assorted females, reputedly the finest one-sex harem in the galaxy. Nipolax presented something of a contrast. The youth was a shambling, gaunt, shoddily clothed figure, blinking in the lights of the arena and clutching a soft toy. The boy was perhaps the second-best damage player in the galaxy, but he always gave his winnings away, and the average Meterbed hotel would have thought twice about admitting him. He was diseased, half-blind, incontinent and albino. His head was liable to shake out of control at an anxious moment in a game, but his hands held holocards as though the plastics had been set in rock. He too was assisted up the ramp by a young girl who helped him to his seat, combed his hair and kissed his cheek, then went to stand in the area behind the 12 seats set immediately aft of the youth's chair. Wilgra raised one of his chubby blue hands and threw a few hundredths at the crowd beyond the fences. People scrabbled for the coins. Wilgra always mixed in a few higher denominations as well. Once, at a game a few years previously, inside a moon heading for a black hole, he had thrown a billion away with a small change, disposing of perhaps 0.1% of his fortune with just one flick of the wrist. a decrepit asteroid tramp who'd just been turned down as a life because he had only one arm, ended up buying his own planet. The rest of the players were a pretty varied-looking bunch as well, but with one exception, Hawser didn't recognise them. Three or four of the others were greeted with shouts and some fireworks, so presumably they were well-known. The rest were either disliked or unknown. The last player to come up the ramp was Craiklin. Hawser settled back in his lounger, smiling. The Free Company leader had had a little temporary facial alteration done, probably pull-off, and his hair was dyed. But it was him, all right. He wore a light-coloured one-piece fabric suit. He was clean-shaven, and his hair was brown. Perhaps the others on the cat wouldn't have recognised him, but Hawser had studied the man to see how he carried himself, how he walked, how the muscles in his face were set. And to the changer, Craiklin stood out like a boulder in a pebble field. When all the players were seated, their lives were led in to sit on the seats immediately behind each player. The lives were all humans. Most already looked half dead anyway, though they were all physically whole. One by one, they were taken to their seats, strapped in and helmeted. The lightweight black helmets covered their faces except for the eyes. Most slumped forward once they were strapped in. A few sat more upright, but none raised their eyes or looked round. All the regular players had the full complement of lives allowed. Some had them specially bred, while others had their agents supply all they wanted. The less rich, not so well-known players, like Craiklin, had the sweepings of prisons and asylums, and a few paid depressives who had willed their share of any proceeds to somebody else. Often, members of the despondent sect could be persuaded to become lives, either for free or for a donation to their cause, but Hawser couldn't see any of their distinctive tiered headdresses or bleeding eye symbols. Craiklin had only managed to find three lives. It didn't look as though he would be staying all that long in the game. The white-haired woman in the reserved seat near the front of the terrace got up, stretched and walked up the terrace, between the couches and loungers, a bored expression on her face. Just as she drew level with Hawser's couch, a commotion erupted on a terrace behind them. The woman stopped and looked. Hawser turned round. Even through the quiet field, he could hear a man shouting. What looked like a fight had broken out. A couple of security guards were trying to restrain two people rolling about on the floor. The crowd on the terrace had made a circle about the disturbance and were looking on, dividing their attention between the preparations for the damage game and the fisticuffs on the terrace beside them. Eventually, the two people on the floor were brought to their feet, but instead of both being restrained, only one was. A youngish man who looked vaguely familiar to Hawser, though he appeared to have been disguising himself with a blonde wig which was now slipping off his head. The other person who had been fighting, another man, produced some sort of card from his clothes and showed it to the young man who was still shouting. Then the two uniformed guards and the man who had brandished the card led the young man away. The man with the card took something small from behind one of the young man's ears as he was frog-marched off to an access tunnel. The young woman with the long white hair crossed her arms and walked on up the terrace. The circle of people on the terrace above closed again like a hole in cloud. Hawser watched the woman weave her way through more couches until she left the terrace and he lost sight of her. He looked up. The dueling animals still spun and leapt. Their white blood seemed to glow as it matted their shaggy hides. They snarled silently and scythed at each other with their long forelimbs, but their acrobatics and their aiming had deteriorated. They were starting to look tired and clumsy. Hawser looked back to the game table. They were all ready, and the game was about to begin. Damage was just a fancy card game. Partly skill, partly luck, and partly bluff. What made it interesting was not just the high sums involved, or even the fact that whenever a player lost a life, he lost a life. A living, breathing human being. But the use of complicated consciousness-altering two-way electronic fields around the game table. With the cards in his or her hand, a player could alter the emotions of another player, or sometimes of several others. Fear, hate, despair, hope, love, camaraderie, doubt, elation, paranoia, virtually every emotional state the human brain was capable of experiencing could be beamed at another player or used for oneself. From far enough away, or in a field shield close in, the game could look like a pastime for the deranged or the simple-minded. A player with an obviously strong hand might suddenly throw it in. Somebody with nothing at all might gamble all the credits they had, People broke down weeping, or started laughing uncontrollably. They might moan with love at a player known to be their worst enemy, or claw at their restraining straps to free themselves for a murdering attack on their best friend. Or they could kill themselves. Damaged players never did get free from their chairs. Should they ever do so, an Ishlorsin army would shoot them with a heavy stun gun, but they could destroy themselves. Each game console from which the MOT units radiated the relevant emotions, on which the cards were played, and where the players could see the time and the number of lives they each had left, contained a small hollow button, inside which a needle filled with poison lay ready to inject any stabbing finger which pushed it. Damage was one of those games in which it was unwise to make too many enemies. Only the very strong-willed indeed could defeat the urge to suicide implanted in their brains by a concerted attack of half a table of players. At the finish of each hand of cards, when the money which had been gambled was taken by the player with the most card points, all the other players who had stayed with the betting lost a life. When they had none left, they were out of the game, as they would be if they ran out of money. The rules said the game ended when only one player had any lives left, though in practice it finished when the remaining contestants agreed that if they stayed any longer, they were likely to lose their own lives to whatever disaster was about to ensue. It could get very interesting at the end of a game when the moment of destruction was very close. The hand had gone on for some time, a great deal of money had been gambled on that one hand, and one or several players would not agree to call it a day. Then the sophisticates really were separated from the simians, and it became even more a game of nerve. Quite a few of the best damage players of the past had perished trying to outdare and outstay each other in such circumstances. From a spectator's point of view, Damage's special attraction was that the closer you stood to the emotor unit of any particular player, the more of the emotions they were experiencing affected you directly too. A whole subculture of people hooked on such third-hand feelings had grown up in the few hundred years since Damage had become such a select but popular game. The Moties. There were other groups playing Damage. The players of the Eve of Destruction were simply the most famous and the richest. The Moties could get their emotional fix in lots of places throughout the galaxy, but only in a full game, only on the edge of annihilation, only with the very best players, plus a few hopefuls, could the most intense experiences be obtained. It was one of these unfortunates Horza had impersonated when he had discovered that an access pass could not be had for less than twice the amount of money he had made on the shuttle. Bribing a door guard had been a lot cheaper. The real Moties were packed tightly behind the fence separating them from the lives. 16 clumps of sweating, nervous-looking people, like the game players, mostly male, they jostled and pressed forward, trying to get near to the table, near to the players. Horza watched them as the cards were dealt by the chief Ishlorsin army. Moties jumped up and down, trying to see what was happening, and the security guards fitted with baffle helmets to keep out the emotor pulses patrolled the perimeter of the fence, tapping nervoprods on their thighs or palms and watching warily.
"Sable the eye," somebody nearby said, and Horza turned to see.
A cadaverous-looking human lying on a couch behind and to Horza's left was talking to another and pointing up to the terrace where the disturbance had occurred a few minutes earlier. Horza heard the words "Sable" and "Caught" a few more times from elsewhere around him as the news spread. He turned round to watch the game as the players started to inspect their hands. The betting began. Horza thought it was a pity the reporter had been caught, but it might mean that the security guards relaxed a little, giving him a better chance of not being asked for his pass. Horza was sitting a good 50 meters from the nearest player, a woman whose name he had heard mentioned but had forgotten. As the first hand progressed, only mild versions of what she was feeling and was being made to feel impinged upon his consciousness. Nevertheless, he didn't enjoy the sensation and switched on the lounger's battlefield, using the small control set on one arm of the couch. Had he wanted, he could have cancelled the immediate effect of the player he just happened to be sitting behind and substituted the effects of any of the other emotor units on the table. The effect would have been nothing like as intense as what the Moties or the lives were experiencing, but it would certainly have given a good idea of what the players were going through. Most of the other people around him were using their lounger's controls in that way, flicking from one player to another in an attempt to judge the overall state of the game. Horza would concentrate on Craiglin's broadcast emotions later, but for now he just wanted to settle in and get the general feel of the game. Craiglin dropped out of the first hand early enough to be sure of avoiding losing a life when it finished. With so few lives of his own, it was the wisest course unless he had a very strong hand.
Horza watched the man carefully as he sat back in his seat and relaxed, his emotor unit dormant. Craiglin licked his lips and wiped his brow. Horza decided in the next hand he would eavesdrop on what Craiglin was going through, just to see what it was like. The hand finished. Wilgra won. He waved, acknowledging the cheers of the crowd. Some motis had fainted already. At the other end of the ellipsoid, in its cage, the Rogathur snarled. Five players lost lives. Five seated humans, sitting hopeless and despairing as the effects of the emotor fields still resounded in them, went suddenly slack in their chairs as their helmets sent a neural blast through their skulls, strong enough to stun the lives sitting around them and to make the nearest motis and the player each life belonged to flinch. Ishlor Sinami undid the restrainers on the dead human seats and carried them away down the access ramp. The remaining lives gradually recovered, but they sat as listless as before. The Ishlor Sinami claimed they always checked that each volunteering life was genuine and that the drugs they gave them simply stopped them from becoming hysterical. But it was rumoured that there were ways round the Ishlor Sinami screening process, and that some people had succeeded in disposing of their enemies by drugging or hypnotising them and volunteering them for the game. As the second hand began, and Horza switched on his couch monitor to experience Craiglin's emotions, the white-haired woman came back down the aisle and resumed her place in front of Horza, at the front of the terrace, draping herself tiredly over the piece of furniture as though she was bored. Horza did not know enough about damage as a card game to be able to follow exactly what was going on with the cards, either by reading the various emotions being passed round the table, or by analysing each hand after it was finished, as the first hand was already being analysed by the hooting tripeds near him, when the cards, as they had been dealt and played, were flashed up on the arena's internal broadcast circuits. But he tuned into Craiglin's feelings just to see what they were like. The captain of the Clear Air Turbulence was being hit from various directions. Some of the emotions were contradictory, which Horza guessed meant that there was no concerted effort being made on Craiglin. He was just taking most people's secondary armament. There was a considerable urge to like Wilgra, that attractive blue colour, and with those four little comical feet he couldn't really be much of a threat, and a bit of a clown, really, for all his money. The woman sitting on Craiglin's right, on the other hand, stripped to the waist with no breasts and a sheath for a ceremonial sword slung across her naked back. She was one to watch. But it was a laugh, really. Nothing really matters. Everything is just a joke. Life is, the game is, one card's pretty much like another when you kind of think about it. For all it matters, might as well throw the lot in the air. It was nearly his turn to play. First that flat-chested bitch. Boy, did he have a card he was going to hit her with. Horza switched off again, unsure whether he was hearing Craiglin's own thoughts about the woman or one somebody else was trying to get him to think about her. He picked up Craiglin's thoughts later on in the hand when the woman was out and sitting back and relaxing, her eyes closed. Horza looked briefly at the white-haired woman on the couch down in front of him. She was watching the game, apparently, but one leg was slung over the side of her lounger, swinging to and fro, as though her mind was somewhere else. Craiglin was feeling good. First of all, that slut next to him was out, and he was sure it was because of some of the cards he had played, but also there was a sort of inner exhilaration. Here he was, playing with the best players in the galaxy. The players. Him. Him. A sudden inhibitory thought blocked out a name he was about to think. And he really wasn't doing that badly at all. He was keeping up. In fact, this hand was looking pretty damn good. At last, things were going right. He was going to win something. Too many things had... Well, there was that... Think about the cards, suddenly. Think about here and now. Yes, the cards. Let's see. I can hit that fat blue oaf with... Horza switched off again. He was sweating. He hadn't fully realised the degree of feedback from the player's mind that was involved. He had thought it was just the emotions beamed at them. He hadn't dreamed he would be so much in Craiglin's mind. Yet this was only a taste of what Craiglin himself was getting full blast, and the motis and lives behind him. Real feedback, only just under control, only just stopping from becoming the emotional equivalent of a loudspeaker howl, building to destruction. Now the changer realised the attraction of the game, and why people had been known to go mad when playing it. Much as he disliked the experience, Horza felt new respect for the man he intended at least to remove and replace, and most likely to kill. Craiglin had a sort of advantage, inasmuch as the thoughts and emotions being beamed back at him were at least partly emanating from his own mind, whereas the lives and the motis had to put up with extremely powerful blasts of what was entirely somebody else's way of feeling something.
All the same, it had to take a considerable strength of character or a vast amount of hard training to be able to handle what Craiglin was obviously coping with. Hawser switched back in again and thought, how do the Moti stand it? And, watch out, maybe this is how they started. Craiglin lost the hand 2 rounds of betting later. The half-blind albino Nipolax was defeated too, and the Suet raked in his winnings, his steel face glowing in the light reflected from the Aoish credits in front of him. Craiglin was slumped in his seat, feeling, Hawser knew, like death. A pulse of a sort of resigned, almost grateful agony swept through Craiglin from behind as his last life died, and Hawser felt it too. He and Craiglin both winced. Hawser switched off and looked at the time. Less than an hour had passed since he had bluffed his way past the guards at the outer doors of the arena. He had some food on a low table by his couch, but he got up all the same and walked away from the table, up the terrace toward the nearest walkway, where food stalls and bars waited. Security guards were checking passes. Hawser saw them moving from person to person on the terrace. He kept his face to the front, but flicked his eyes from side to side, watching the guards as they moved. One was almost directly in his path, bending to ask an old-looking female